Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Thank you all for joining us today. I have the privilege of introducing our speakers for this afternoon's seminar. We're joined by Margaret Fortuna and Jill Sharif, both of Commonwealth Land Title. And they both underwrite for Fidelity and Chicago as well. Margaret is Vice President and Senior Commercial Underwriting Counsel in the National Commercial Services Operation. She joined the company in July 2015. After having previously worked for another underwriter, her previous roles include Massachusetts Underwriting and Claims Council, Southern New England Claims Council, New England Claims Council. And prior to working as a title insurance underwriter, Margaret was in private practice where she gained experience in residential conveyancing, title examination, both residential and commercial, and provided title opinions to the cell and wireless communications industry as outside counsel. A true collaborator, her approachability, responsiveness, as well as her immense underwriting experience allows her to delineate the underwriting risk and the customer needs. Margaret is a member of the Abstract Club, the Real Estate Bar Association for Massachusetts, and sits on the Title Standards Committee, and she's a member of the Massachusetts Bar Association as well. She's a contributing author to MCLE's Massachusetts Mortgages, Foreclosures, and Workouts Manual, and is a frequent panelist for various MCLE seminars. Margaret graduated from Boston College in 1989 with a BA in political science cum laude and Boston College Law School in 1992. She's an avid Red Sox and Patriots fan and a Boston College Eagles fan.
That's right. Go Eagles!
And Jill Sharif is Vice President of National Business Development in the National Commercial Services Operation at Commonwealth. Prior to joining Boston NCS in 2021, she worked for another major underwriter where she was consistently recognized company-wide as one of the highest performing members of the sales and escrow teams for commercial real estate transactions in the country. She has worked on numerous complex single and multi-site transactions throughout the country for all asset classes, some of which have been with my team here. So we're very familiar with Jill and Margaret's underwriting and customer service acumen. Leading voice in the title industry, Jill has participated on many industry panels. She's spoken at several university classrooms and career events, clarifying and expanding on title insurance. In addition to title insurance, she's one of the leading experts on the application of UCC insurance, Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code, and title insurance in mezzanine transactions. Jill has also provided numerous CLE presentations to companies that want a detailed look at UCC and other commercial transactions, and co-authored Mitigating the Risk of a Loan Portfolio Acquisition with UCC Insurance, published by The Practical Real Estate Lawyer. Jill is a past president of CREW Boston, one of the largest CREW network chapters. During her time as president, she refocused and led the organization through the height of the pandemic and is currently serving as the chair of CREW Boston's DE&I Task Force. In 2018, Jill was among the many participants honored with the CREW Boston Networking Award for her contributions to the One Dalton Project in Boston. She was named the 80th CREW Visionary in 2020, a recognition for charitable giving to advance the careers of women in commercial real estate. In 2021, the Boston Real Estate Times honored Jill as one of 10 outstanding women leaders in Boston commercial real estate. Also in 2021, she was recognized by the GlobeStreet.com Women of Influence Awards as a diversity champion for her groundbreaking work with CREW Boston on diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. She's currently the 2024 president-elect for REFA, an association formed to bring together the best people, knowledge, and experience to provide informative programs and networking opportunities for commercial real estate professionals throughout the greater Boston area with over 700 members. In 2024, she'll be honored with the CREW Boston Leadership Award, which recognizes members who have inspired, motivated, and supported Crew Boston year after year, and contributed time, energy, and talents in leadership roles with the greater Boston real estate community. She's also a member of ICSC, NAIOP, Gavel member, REFA, and ULI, serving on the URC Product Council. Jill is a graduate of UConn and a member of the UConn Boston Leadership Committee. This group is tasked with increasing UConn's visibility by building stronger networks among UConn alumni, supporting more jobs for UConn students in the Boston area, supporting philanthropy, and promoting corporate scholarships and research. She has also been a member of the Heading Home Housewarming Committee for the past 3 years. This year, in place of Heading Home's housewarming event, teams of Boston leaders set out to raise $1 million for Heading Home. As a result, over 200 industry leaders raised over $2 million to help families exit homelessness. Jill's on the Wonder Woman team, which raised the second highest amount for the campaign. And Jill lives in Sudbury with her husband and twin daughters, and in her spare time enjoys golf, tennis, and pickleball.
Spare time.
So again, we really appreciate you both joining us today, and I will turn it over to you to begin the presentation.
Geez, it feels like at this point we could say thank you. Good night.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the commercial real estate title insurance presentation today. Before we begin, I know Jill and I want to thank Spencer and Clayton for inviting us to be with them here today. I think the best place to start is probably with the question of what is title insurance, or what is a title insurance policy? Title insurance policy is a contract of indemnity, and it insures the insured against loss or damage incurred as a result of certain enumerated risks that are set forth in the jacket of the policy. And those coverages are subject to the conditions, exclusions, and exceptions that are also set forth in the policy. And particularly in the case of a commercial title insurance policy, also subject to the endorsement coverages that are provided therein. Again, it's important to remember that it's a contract of indemnity and not a guarantee of title. The insurer, or the title insurance company, is the financially responsible party, and their liability is strictly set forth within the contract itself, within the title insurance policy, what is contained therein, and sometimes what isn't contained therein. In addition to being a contract of indemnity, the title insurance policy also outlines the company's, or the title insurance company's, obligations to its insured with respect to its duty to defend when an insured is named as a defendant in litigation that has some sort of title challenge at its heart. What types of interests can we insure? What types of real estate interests can be insured? Well, obviously, the fee ownership, where you own a piece of property, leasehold interests, mortgagees or lenders' interests in a loan policy, and appurtenant easements, otherwise known as easements that benefit your parcel.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, title insurance is all of that for sure. But what also title insurance is, it's a key part of due diligence, right? It's a key part of the due diligence performed by the investors prior to acquiring an interest in commercial real estate, right? So they need to understand that the full value of the policy is realized when an insured, or as more often the case, their legal team, as we've heard, works closely with us to obtain not only the most appropriate coverage available, but also to fully understand any title issues disclosed by the title examination. So I just want to add that.
No, I like this.
This point. Is the lawyer side versus the sales
this
side.
This is the point counterpoint. I love this. And as long as I can be Jane Curtin, we'll be good. What does a title insurance policy cover? And this next slide sort of gives an overview of what some of the issues are that it covers. For example, fraud, forgery, lack of capacity or authority in connection with the documents that are executed to establish the interest that we're insuring. Non-discharged liens of record that predate the effective date of the policy, or say unrecorded liens for things like property taxes or municipal utilities that were due and payable prior to the effective date of the policy, but for whatever reason were never paid. Issues related to encroachments. For example, if your building is over a lot line into a neighbor's property, or maybe your neighbor's building is over the lot line into your property. Big one, incorrect legal descriptions, whether a parcel for whatever reason was dropped from a deed or was dropped from the legal description of a mortgage, or if there is a boundary dispute between landowners. Easements, particularly, as we said, you know, appurtenant easements as to access, whether that access is used for your primary access or your secondary access. Unknown owners that or missing interest issues, unfortunately, were people that you didn't expect come out of the woodwork and claim to have an interest in your title. And again, survey errors. You know, we talked about boundary issues, missing parcels, survey issues, and the like.
They fly in.
They fly in. Look it. Let's pop those up. Just to people oftentimes are interested in, you know, what are the most common title insurance claims that you see? And we've listed sort of a group here of the top 10. And you'll see that most of the items on this list involved human error issues, whether something was missed in a title search, such as a missed interest, ownership interest, a missed mortgage, a missed easement, or some other encumbrance of record, or even perhaps something that was misindexed by the registry and therefore wasn't found by the examiner. You know, documents that perhaps were drafted in such a way that they didn't quite effectuate the intent of the parties. Let's say that you have parties that meant to give an access easement, and for whatever reason, maybe an owner was missing that needed to execute the document, or maybe the incorrect owner was listed, or maybe the description was faulty, maybe the notary was faulty. You know, and finally, I have in here, underwriters are human too. Item 8 is underwritten risk. We can make errors in judgment as well. And anyone who remembers the foreclosure line of cases that started about 12, 15 years ago with the Ibanez decision knows that for years we thought that we were doing things correctly by allowing assignments to go to record to cure a link between the original lender and the foreclosing lender post foreclosure. And lo and behold, we found out, gee, that's not the right way to do things. So, you know, the underwriter can make what they did, what they feel is a well-reasoned decision, and then find out at some time or at some point later that they were in fact wrong. And some of the other items on this list deal with matters I would label gently more of wrongdoing, whether that be fraudulent or forged documents, deeds, or mortgages, whether that be defalcations or mishandling of funds or documents per closing protection letter or insured protection letter for one of our agents.
So just to stop here for a minute, these are in no particular order, but mechanics liens is definitely a hot button right now. And we could spend hours on mechanics liens. And, you know, Clayton and Spencer, if you're ever looking for a topic, you know, another topic, we'd be happy to talk about mechanics liens as they relate in the Massachusetts, which is one jurisdiction that we are very grateful for in the mechanics liens yes. laws. But then you have some other states where it's very tricky, like such as California and Illinois, where if I draw a plan on a napkin, like priority's already broken. I mean, it can be that simple in order to lose a priority. So we're spending a lot of our time right now underwriting the mechanics lien risks. And then search and exam, I just want to talk about search and exam. Sure. Maybe you'll bring this up later, but legal description issues, you know, it's interesting. I love this world. Every deal is different. We learn so much. I learn something every day, and, you know, it ebbs and flows with issues. And it seems lately we bumped into some legal description issues. And, you know, obviously in Massachusetts, where we still, you know, search at the registries, we have, you know, those long legal descriptions with the calls.
By the spotted tree.
By the spotted tree. And you think that we've probably insured that every, you know, commercial building out here has been insured or there's, you know, a proper legal description, but we're finding more and more like these small little triangles of parcels that are missing in a land assemblage. So we are spending a lot of time on that, I feel too.
Yeah, that's true. We were talking about that today.
Yes. So I just wanted to touch briefly, like, how does title insurance compare with other types of insurance? And most insurance, as you know, is designed to protect against a possible specific loss in the future. So, but title insurance generally insures losses caused by title problems that have their source in the past, right? So this often results in, as Margaret's going to say, or said, in curing title defects, elimination of adverse interest from title before the transaction takes place, right? Where my car and auto policies are looking towards the future. And, you know, so a difference with title insurance, but between title insurance and, you know, the auto and home type of insurance is like, there is no actuarial foundation. So, and what I mean by that is insurance companies can, with a pretty good degree of certainty based on actuarial analysis, know the percentage likelihood that a 16-year-old boy is going to get in a car accident as soon as he gets his license, or this house in this area that's, you know, within a wildfire region, right, is going to burn down. So they can look at that data to say, like, okay, this is what we think the risk is. Title insurance is very different from that. We don't have that foundation to review. It's, you know, we take each deal and each property by itself, and we have to look at the whole transaction and say, like, okay, what's the risk here? And again, it's a risk elimination insurance. That's what I say. Like, title insurance is risk elimination. If we do our job well upfront, typically we can eliminate a lot of the risk, you know, of future claims. We try to, right?
I like risk mitigation.
Mitigation. There you go. So just kind of a little bit of the similarities and differences between title insurance versus, you know, your regular property and casualty type insurance. And then comparing it with residential title insurance, very different. You know, I actually had I bought a house, I bought like an enhanced title policy, and I know what it is, but it's still very different than commercial title insurance. You know, obviously similar in that they offer protection for me as a buyer or the lender, for anybody that holds the interest in the property. It's a one-time premium and it includes coverage for loss. Differences, though, are the price and the scope of coverage. So residential, even in Massachusetts, and I'll talk about rates in a minute, but the price is going to be different on a residential policy than it will be for a commercial title policy, and the scope of coverage is going to be different. The biggest difference is the gap coverage. So in residential transactions, you know, the seller won't get their money until, you know, the mortgage, everything's on record. Where, you know, on a commercial transaction, we're advancing those funds before we get on record, before we even submit the documents on record.
Right.
And then we focus on survey and zoning, as you know, as most of you know. We need to be certain that the land purchase is able to be used for commercial purposes. So that's the zoning part of it. But the survey is a critical piece in our underwriting analysis, where on a residential transaction, I think I got a copy of my plat and that was it, right?
Yeah, and you're lucky to get that.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
here, look, it's in the line.
Yeah, your house in the middle of the box.
That's right in the middle.
And then also UCC liens. You see UCC liens filed at the county level and also, you know, sometimes at the Delaware Secretary of State level, depending what the lender's taking interest in. But yeah, you don't have UCC liens on residential transactions. Right.
And before we move on, I think from my perspective, I think the biggest similarity between the two is title. And you'll hear underwriters say, title is title. It's not that the title rules change from a residential transaction to a commercial transaction. You might be dealing with certain issues that you wouldn't be dealing necessarily in the other realm. For example, on a residential transaction, maybe you're dealing with looking at divorce records. Maybe you're dealing with homestead issues. You've got the 1-4 family residential Fannie Mae mortgage, versus on the commercial side of the transaction, you're dealing more with authority issues. What's the authority of this person to execute documents on behalf of the entity that we're insuring, and the like? So really, title is title, rules don't change. Biggest similarity. The biggest difference for me, as far as just focusing on the policy itself, Our title insurers provide their owners, regardless of whether or invite, provide their insureds, whether they're in the residential setting or the commercial setting, with the opportunity to have enhanced coverages. In the residential 1-4 situation, those coverages are provided in the jacket. And whether a company calls it a homeowner's jacket, whether it's called an enhanced owner's jacket, whether it's called an Eagle policy, whatever it's called, there are additional covered risks as to, say, zoning matters or survey matters that are set forth in that jacket. Oftentimes, you will see that because those additional coverages are causing additional exposure to the company, the jackets will have maybe caps or ceilings on the liability of the company. Maybe there's a deductible that's put therein. But in the residential setting, in the 1-4 family, there are enhanced owner's jackets that are made for those situations. Versus on the commercial side, you never use those enhanced jackets. Those are residential 1-4 only. On the commercial side, you use the standard Alta jackets. And the way those insureds get enhanced coverage is by the negotiation of the coverages, whether it is negotiation of the inclusion of matters in the Schedule B, whether it's the addition of endorsement coverages that are provided that we're going to talk about in a little bit. But it's just a different means to an end. And because in those situations with a commercial policy, the exposure is so great. You don't have caps. You don't have limits. The liability amounts are so many times more than what you're dealing with on the residential side of the equation, that your underwriter is going to require certain documentation and information. You know, Jill mentioned zoning. She mentioned survey that we're going to want to look at in order to negotiate those coverages.
So title insurance, while Margaret says the policy is the same, which it is, and we're into the 2021 policy jackets now in most jurisdictions, not all of them have approved them, but we're getting there. They could have approved the jacket, but not the endorsements, but we'll talk about that in a minute. But so you can have promulgated, filed, and negotiated rates. You can have promulgated, filed, and negotiated forms, and then you can have partially filed. All very confusing. So when we say promulgated, promulgated means that it's been adopted by the insurance bureau of that jurisdiction. So for example, Texas, New York, these are promulgated states. So not only are their rates promulgated, but as well as their forms, meaning that you're not changing them. You can't change the coverage. They're limited to, as to the endorsements. You're not changing the rates. The rates are the rates, and you're not, there's no negotiation in those rates. When you have filed rates, it's everybody has, each underwriter has filed their rates, and they're probably pretty similar, but they might not be exact. So while they're filed, there's no wiggle room in that or no negotiation in that. It's not, it was not set by the Department of Insurance. So that's a little bit different than the promulgated, which is. And then there's negotiated rates. Welcome to the state of Massachusetts, where we have negotiated rates. And the call that I get a lot is, why, Jill, is a $100 million policy maybe $50,000 in Massachusetts, but it's $350,000 in Texas? That is just the variation of the rates in depending, again, if it's set by the title insurance bureaus, if it's set by the underwriters in the jurisdiction, the rates do differ depending on the state. There are some states where we're very similar, but then there's some that it is very different. So that's why you can always feel free to call me and I can give you the quote, but just know it's not going to be the same in every state. And then the forms too are different a little bit, especially like in Texas, Florida has specific forms. Pennsylvania has their own forms too. And then also, especially California, they have the CLTA forms. Yep. And we get that request a lot. Can you give the CLTA on, you know, a policy in New York or in like a different state? And some states have adopted a CLTA, but that's very few. You're just going to get those forms and those endorsements in California and those forms in California. So it's very important to, you know, obviously understand the rules within the where the property is located. So now we come to you guys have your client, your customer, you've been looking at a property. you've been probably doing a little bit of your own due diligence and now you need to order the title report. You're like, okay, we're definitely going to move forward with this transaction. So you want to order the title report. So then you reach out to me and what am I going to ask you for? Yeah. I definitely would love to see a prior policy. You know, some prior policies we can use more than others in that depending, you know, how old is the policy? You know, what was the liability amount under the policy? There are a lot of factors that go into the prior policy, but the most important thing I think in the prior policy is the legal description. Mm-hmm. We want to see the legal description to make sure that when we tell our examiner or when we reach out to the plant to do the title search, like we're comparing apples to apples when it comes to the legal description. And having a prior policy significantly can reduce the time and sometimes the cost, depending on the jurisdiction, especially when you're in a state like Massachusetts, where we still use examiners. It definitely could lower the cost and as well as the search time. So how long till the title report is delivered? That really depends. But I do want to make clear on this call, it's definitely a lead time item. You know, there's a lot of times people are calling us and like, I need, you know, calling me on Monday saying I need it on Friday. That might be okay in some jurisdictions. It's not really going to fly here in Massachusetts. It's not going to fly in most states, to be honest, unless you're really like in Texas, maybe ordering from a plant or possibly in California. So what I like to say is when, you know, if we have those states, we're a minimum of 5 business days, I would say. I mean, that's quick. But when you're in Massachusetts, I'm saying like 8 to 10 business days just to be safe. So give yourself like 2 weeks for the title commitment to come in. And again, that's going to depend on the complexity of it as well. And that goes to the cost too. So when you have examiners such as in Massachusetts and some of the other states, it's going to be more costly than if you're going to a plant in California. And then another thing back on, just to circle back on the rates, like in California, in Texas, for example, the cost of the title search is included in the premium. So there is no additional cost unless the deal cancels, then you have to pay the nominal fee for that. But, you know, when you're in a plant jurisdiction, the cost is going to be much cheaper than it is going to be if you're searching here in Massachusetts, for example.
Or we have a third party vendor.
Right. So if you don't have the prior policy, then we're going to want property, as much property information as you can get, block and lot. Address sometimes works. I know people always send me the address. They're like, oh, here's the address. And I can't tell you how many times the address that you're giving me is not what the tax assessor has, or it's not going to come up. So we really are looking for the legal description, definitely the current owner name. We need that. Again, any prior title work you might have, and even the survey will help. Survey will always have typically have the legal description. If you don't have the commitment that's referenced in the survey, it at least gives us the legal description that was in the commitment.
And just to clarify, you're talking about the prior survey.
Prior survey. Yep. So again, very important lead time item. So even if you're thinking about like this might go, and I know it's a very wonky type of market out there right now. So even if you think it's going to go down, like it may or may not go forward, if you're close and you know it's going to be a tight time turnaround, like reach out to me and say, Jill, like, okay, how much is this title search going to cost and how long will it take to get delivered? Because sometimes, you know, I have customers that really wish they had just spent the $850 or $1,500 to get that title search going. So they had the commitment when they were really had to get going. And then, you know, then it becomes like a fire drill for everybody because you need my title commitment in order to get the survey done. So
right.
If my advice is to, you know, order the title search as soon as you can. So, you know, there is time to get it done.
And if I can just add one minor point and just, you know, I know the people on this call probably already know this, but this is where folks like Jill are so crucial. I mean, this is the reason why NCS offices are here, is that Jill has access and we have contacts all over the country in order to get you this information as quickly as possible so that you're not stuck calling around from jurisdiction to jurisdiction trying to find out this information yourself. What Jill offers is one point of contact, regardless of where the property is, and she can help you with these questions that you're looking for answers to.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's also true.
And then to the extent that you can provide us as much transaction information upfront as possible, that would be really appreciated. I know sometimes title is a little bit forgotten and that's okay. It doesn't hurt our feelings, but it makes it tricky for us to really customize the commitment the way it should be given the structure of the transaction. And then obviously when we're getting further down, preparing the pro forma, which Margaret will talk about, like we need to have as much information as possible because we obviously don't want any delays as we're getting towards closing. So if we, you know, if you don't, if somebody doesn't tell us that work is being done on the property, we will ask. But if we don't find out until like a couple of weeks before, and there's a mechanics lien risk that has to be underwritten, that can really put a it's definitely a bump in the road that will need to be addressed. And we don't obviously want to be the reason that the property and the transaction doesn't close. We don't want to delay it at all. So to the extent that you can give us as much transaction information as possible upfront, obviously, you know, if it's an acquisition or a refinance, so that one's easy. Owner's policy, lender's policy, respective liability amounts. Yeah, we typically don't get the liability amounts until the end,
yeah,
for whatever reason, but we need to know a ballpark just to know, you know, how the transaction is going to be underwritten. You know, because sometimes there's different risks, right? So we need to know at least an idea as to the liability amounts. And what's happening a lot now is lenders' policies are being issued maybe 60 to 90 days after closing because they can't, the financing is just not there yet. So the buyer is going to pay cash and then we're like, okay, we'll put the loan on later. So that's something that's very important to us to know when underwriting like the lender's policy and the owner's policy. Are we keeping it open? Spencer, do you have a question?
I just wanted to ask, is there a, does particularly the liability amount, but any of these other issues that you're raising on this slide, do they affect what coverages would be available at, or the pricing, or even how long it takes to get the title examination done? Like, do you go back? Is it a more extensive title examination for a $100 million policy than a $5 million policy?
I would say generally no. We use a similar search parameters for all the transactions. That's a great question, Spencer, because I think, you know, that is a misconception out there that, you know, the lower the liability amount, the less we might have to do a search. But no, I would say no.
No, and that goes back to title is title.
Yeah.
You know, I think the key there, as far as the information that's on the slide right now, is to the extent that we get a back policy that, you know, we can rely on. I think Jill mentioned that, you know, oftentimes that will enable us to maybe shorten the scope of our search, or the examiner's search, and the like. So that does impact, you know, timing and pricing and the like. But no, as far as the amount of the liability, it title is title.
If you have an idea, so closing date, that's always extremely helpful. You know, even not exact, just if you know it's going to be closing within the quarter, within the next couple of months, that'd be great. Buyer seller information. A lot of times the contracts are signed by just the general entity, and then it's going to be dropped into the special purpose entity later. That's fine. You know, as soon as you know the buying entity, that would be helpful because it helps to populate other fields for us, whether it's within the settlement statement, obviously the pro forma. Seller information, we should already have that from the PSA, from pulling the title, pulling the tax records. The lender, obviously provide us a lender. And then parties, attorneys, we usually know them pretty early on.
Yeah, we'll hear from them.
We definitely hear from them. Amount of insurance, again, goes back to liability amounts. And then do you need any additional searches, such as zoning, MLCs, or any municipal searches? Zoning reports, you know, definitely a lead time item. Those are taking longer for the municipalities, just for what, I don't know if they're shorthanded or what, but zoning reports are taking a very long time. So to the extent you haven't ordered the zoning report when you're ordering title, I would recommend you do that. MLCs, the tax certificates, those vary by jurisdiction. Depending when the transaction's closing is when we will order the tax certificate. And then municipal searches, I think of those more like the New York ones. You can get like CO, elevator, sidewalk type of searches. So if you need those ordered, we can order those as well.
So let's say we've ordered the title report. My office gets their title report in, and, you know, what are we looking at? Well, I know it's obvious. The first thing we do is we read it. Don't just rely on the cover page. Make sure that we have copies of all encumbrances that are listed. We read through the abstract ourselves. You know, the title examiner will highlight things for you. You know, maybe they found an easement here, or maybe they found a lease there. But they're also anticipating that you're going to go through and you're going to read through those materials and pick up, you know, perhaps there's a right of first refusal in that lease that they reference the notice of lease or something like that. So, you know, for me, I want to make sure I have my correct current owner. I want to take a look at my descriptions and make sure my descriptions are accurate. And then I want to look through the title and see if there's anything that off the bat's going to raise a red flag for me. You know, what are the old financial liens? And what are the financial liens out there that we're going to require are terminated at or prior to closing? And you can look and you can see, you know, if there are two mortgages out there that are outstanding and they're about the same amount and they're a few years apart, you know, you probably know that you've got a missing discharge situation that it will need to be addressed.
Let's talk about that for a second, because sure. I think there's a misconception too. Like if we're paying off a loan, like to Wells Fargo or Bank of America, we take a payoff letter. It has the language in there that we need. But when you have like a mortgage from a private lender or a private person, like that's...
Sure. Well, there are a couple of things. I mean, number one, the example I raised is, a paper chasing situation where somebody else prior to us paid off a mortgage, a prior transaction, paid off a mortgage and didn't get the discharge to record. And, you know, we try to highlight that as soon as possible so that the seller in the sale or the borrower in the refinance transaction, can get working on that. You know, there are other options that may be available. Perhaps there's an owner's title insurance policy out there that didn't take exception for it. And perhaps, you know, we could take an indemnity from another company with an undertaking to fix it. And if the mortgage itself is a private mortgage, let's say you have an institutional loan and a private loan as a second mortgage, you know, the requirements are a little different. You know, where you're looking at an institutional loan where you get the payoff letter and, you know, we collect the funds on the settlement statement, we wire out the payoff, and then we wait for the discharge to come in. In a private loan situation or a private mortgage situation, I think also similar to a residential transaction, we want to be holding on to that discharge in escrow at the time of closing. And, you know, it is, sometimes we receive escrow instructions from the attorney representing that private lender that says, hold on to this discharge until I confirm for you that the wire has been received by the private lender. And then you can put the discharge of record. So basically, and Clayton, I see you pop up. Is there a question?
It was on the your point on indemnities and undertakings. Could you speak a little bit more on that for the group about, kind of your guidance and guidelines when it comes to, you know, when an issue is big enough that there should be an indemnity on an undertaking, and when that issue maybe becomes a little too big for accepting an indemnity in lieu of the issue being resolved prior to closing?
Sure thing. And there are a couple of things we look at, and there are a couple of things that a buyer's attorney should look at. Number one, as Clayton accurately pointed out, it's the issue. You know, is this a paper chasing issue? You know, as far as we have evidence that the folks prior to us actually paid off this loan, but, you know, for whatever reason, the discharge never made it to record. So it's going to take a little bit of additional time than what we have in order for them to go chase down that discharge. From my company's perspective, you know, we didn't insure that. You know, somebody else insured that, and that's their responsibility to go finish their obligations in connection with their transaction. But in order for us to move forward and not take exception on the new buyer's policy or the new lender's policy, in those types of situations, we'll often take an indemnity and undertaking from another title insurance company that says, hey, we recognize this didn't get done. We're going to take care of it. And then we'll let you know when the issue is resolved. And that enables us to write our policies clean as to that issue. But, you know, you could also be looking at issues that maybe are a little bit too significant. And the buyer may want to take another look at is, you know, what if you actually have a missing interest? What if there's an absolute missing parcel that never got conveyed? In a deed, we talked about some of these issues before. Title insurers will limit their liability when they're issuing an indemnity to the amount of their policy. So, you know, what if we're looking and there's this significant issue from the point of view of the company, and we've got a missing interest, and the prior title insurance company's policy is $2 million, and maybe it was pre-construction or $5 million, and I've got a $50 million policy and I've got a missing interest, then we're going to look at that. And we're going to look at that long and hard as to whether or not that's going to be an acceptable indemnity or an acceptable approach for us. So thank you, Clayton, for the question. Just moving on, I know Jill already pointed out time to me, but so I take the information from the title report and we put it into a commitment, a title commitment. And what is a title commitment? From my perspective, a title commitment is a snapshot of the status of title at a certain point in time. And that's the effective date and time of that commitment. I mean, title to me is really a story. It you know, title runs from A to B, B to C, and then hopefully C to D. And during those periods of ownership, those owners have given certain encumbrances, whether they're mortgages, easements, leases, and there may be found by the examiner terminations of those documents. They may be expired by their own terms. They may be expired by statute, in which case those matters will never be reported to me in that title report. But everything else that's outstanding will be reported to me. And according to title, they affect your property and they affect and they'll be listed in the Schedule B2 as exceptions. So just briefly going through what the schedules are in the commitment. Schedule A in the commitment tells you who and what the company is going to insure. So, you know, basically, are we anticipating issuing an owner's policy? Are we anticipating issuing a loan policy? What's the anticipated liability amount? As Jill previously pointed out, we often don't know those liability amounts when we're issuing the commitment. So maybe we'll put in a placeholder of $10,000 or $100,000, which as we move along in the transaction will be adjusted once we get more information as to the liability. We'll detail who the current owner is and who we anticipate our new insurance to be. And we'll also detail by virtue of an Exhibit A, the legal description of the property that we anticipate insuring. Schedule B1 is the requirements section. And this sets forth and enumerates a list of requirements that the company is going to look to be satisfied in order to insure the interest that you're looking to be insured. Whether they're matters of authority, what type of documentation we want in that regard, whether it's matters of what type of documentation we're going to want to see in order to insure an interest, deed, notice of lease and lease, mortgage, depending on the type of policy.
Authority documents in there. The requirements.
And absolutely, and authority documents. And something that I want to point out now is that, you know, Massachusetts has a very favorable system as far as priority is concerned, because we have statutory protections in the corporation statute and the LLC statute, that which basically say if you're a bona fide purchaser and these certain people sign, whether it's on behalf of a corporation or on behalf of an LLC, that you have these protections built into the statute. So that allows us to, you know, rely on, okay, well, if certain officers sign, then we're okay. We can assume that we're okay as far as authority. If we have a manager of an LLC or we have an authorized real estate signatory sign, then we're okay as to authority. In other states, though, they don't have those types of protections. So in other states, you may be asked to provide, you know, for an LLC, the operating agreement, any amendments thereto, all the filings, all the corporate filings for a corporation, resolutions authorizing a person to sign, consent of the members for the LLC. This information, again, is listed in your requirements. So make sure you look through there and see what the company or the title insurance company is going to be asking you for. Moving on, when you get your commitment, get that commitment to your surveyor so that the surveyor can start putting together the first draft of the survey, plotting the exceptions, showing the encroachments. In the interim, you should be looking at the documentation that we're linking, the exception documentation, the title documentation, the legal description documentation, and reading through that. As far as the encumbrances of record that are listed in the B2, you know what your client anticipates doing with that property. Is there anything of record that would interfere with your client doing what they're anticipating doing? So, you know, start reading through the matters as soon as you're provided with the commitment. Again, just moving on to the Schedule B items I touched upon briefly before, read the requirements, make sure you understand what's going to be required of you as far as authority. Make sure you understand what's going to be required of you as far as payoffs and lien encumbrances that need to be terminated either at or prior to closing. Make sure you understand other states, unlike Massachusetts, Massachusetts doesn't have transfer tax forms or transfer forms. Other states do. So what are these forms that you're going to be required to provide that will need to be presented either, you know, prior to the recording of the deed or maybe at the time of the recording of the deed? As far as the B2 items, you know, this is where the negotiation of coverage starts. And we talked about that a little bit earlier, that in a commercial title insurance setting, that the negotiation of the exceptions that are included in the final policy and the endorsements are what gives enhanced coverage to that insured. So, you know, start with what are we going to get for an owner's affidavit? Are the statements that are being made in that owner's affidavit going to enable us to revise or omit standard exceptions such as parties in possession exceptions or mechanics lien exceptions? You know, we talked a little bit, we touched on before gap closing.
Wait, hold on the owner's affidavit. Please don't give that to us at the last minute.
Yeah.
We really need to review that. I know customers sometimes think, oh, we can just get it to them like a day or two before, but there's a lot of information that we use to underwrite the risks, especially if we're taking special statements in the title affidavit in order to maybe remove exceptions or ensure additional risks. Like, we need to see that title affidavit early.
You know, gap indemnities in our forms, the gap indemnity language is included within that owner's title affidavit. And that enables us in order to do what, you know, we referred to before as the gap closing, meaning dispersing first and then going to record thereafter.
And that's just gap indemnities. Sometimes you'll have transactions with non-imputation in them. That is something we really need to know early on because we need to understand the pre-closing structure, the post-closing structure, and we need to put together the non-imputation indemnity for review, you know, and that I have seen lately, especially has taken a lot of back and forth and conversation. So put that at the top of the list with the title affidavit.
Cool. And then surveys. For example, the surveyor is out there plotting the exceptions for us. And maybe the surveyor is noting to us, well, you know, this exception is non-locus. It doesn't affect this property. And they'll put that statement on the survey. And that's the comfort and the backup we'll look for as far as whether or not we can omit that exception.
I know we're pressed on time, but, yeah. You know, when you're talking about the commitment in the surveys, a lot of times we're asked to remove can we delete the exception in the commitment?
Yeah.
And I know we're getting into pro forma policy, so maybe we could talk about that, like when we will delete the exception in the commitment, but most times we will leave it because we want the record of it.
Right. And just going to move on to pro forma policy. So a pro forma policy is what the policy will look like if all the requirements are met from the commitment. And this is where, as you're negotiating your coverages, you're going to see the coverages you're negotiating in the pro forma. So the question Jill raised is, let's say the survey says that something is non-locus, that an encumbrance or exception we've listed is non-locus. And the request is, well, omit the exception, omit it from the pro forma, and omit it from the commitment. Now, remember, the survey is based upon our commitment. If we omit the exception from the commitment, when you send that revised commitment to the surveyor, that exception and their statement on which I'm relying, saying that the item is non-locus, will be removed from the survey. So that's why oftentimes you'll hear underwriters like me say to you, I have no problem omitting the matter from the pro forma. You know, if you want, I'll even put a note in the commitment telling you that so long as that statement stays in the survey, this exception will not appear in your final policy. But keep in mind, you know, that's one of the things I'm relying on because title says it affects. And that statement in the survey is the only thing that's telling me it doesn't. So I need that statement to remain. The pro forma will also set forth, you know, certain additional requirements. You know, maybe it'll have a note that says this is still subject to payment of premium. It's subject to, you know, whatever we find in title updates as we get closer to closing. You know, affidavits, as we mentioned before, and indemnities will need to be provided for closing. So again, it's important to keep in mind the pro forma does two things. It shows you what the final policy is going to look like, presuming that all conditions in the commitment are met or all requirements are met. And it also sets forth the coverages that you've negotiated with your underwriter to date.
That's really fast.
Really fast. probably the most boring thing I will ever tell you is you really should actually read an entire policy and know what's in the jacket in order to understand the full coverages that are being provided to your client.
The jackets did change. There's some differences between 2006 and 2021. So,
right. And I know that's got to be one of the most boring things I will ever tell you. But understand, when you're talking about overall coverage provided by a policy, you start with the covered risks. That's the title insurer given. And then you take away the conditions and you look at the impact of the conditions and you look at the impact of the exclusions and you look at the impact of the exceptions. And that's the title insurance company taketh away. And then you look at the endorsements, and what the endorsements do is either they will expand upon the covered risks and the coverages that are provided, or they will limit the impact of the exclusions, exceptions, and conditions. So really, to get the whole picture of what your customer or your client is being provided, you need to understand how these parts of the puzzle operate together.
Endorsements. All right, I'll put
them off. Endorsements. Okay, this is Massachusetts. This is Massachusetts focused. Not all of these endorsements, as Jill alluded to, are available in every state. Some of them in other states will incur additional premium. So this slide, for our purposes, is focused on Massachusetts and common commercial endorsements that were asked for. So starting with the Alta 3 series of zoning, if you're going to ask me for this Alta 3 series, the most common being the Alta 3.1 for improved structures, I'm going to ask you for something in return so that I can make sure that I am providing doing my due diligence and providing this coverage. I'm going to ask you for a title report. And I'm going to ask you for a title report that covers the issues or the coverages that we're setting forth in the endorsement. For example, in the 3.1, we talk about what zone are we in, we talk about what are the allowed uses, and we talk about whether the property is currently in compliance with the zoning requirements. And so hopefully that report addresses all three issues. The Alta 3 deals with vacant land. So obviously the report in that circumstance would be dealing with the zone and the use only and wouldn't be concerned with whether or not the current property is in compliance with dimensional requirements. That endorsement or the zoning endorsements are available to both owner and the lender. The Alta 6 variable loan is a lender-only endorsement. And the question you're going to get as far as that endorsement is concerned is, where in the mortgage is the variable rate component set forth in the mortgage? Is it set forth in the loan agreement? If it isn't, then maybe you don't have a variable rate loan and the endorsement is not applicable. And if it's not applicable, then obviously it won't be issued and it won't be included.
In some jurisdictions, though, we've seen that they need to see that language in the mortgage.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise we're not going to be able to issue the endorsement. Again, state specific. It does happen.
The Alta 8.2, the commercial environmental, for those of you familiar with doing residential transactions, you're probably used to issuing the 8.1. The 8.2 is what we use in the commercial context. And essentially, it's generally issued so long as there's no type of violation or environmental enforcement order of record that's found of record. The Alta 9 series has a list of endorsements that is included in there. Which version or which endorsement depends on what type of policy you're issuing. Are you issuing an owner's policy or a loan policy? Is the land vacant? Is the land improved? Is the land under development? In which case, you know, hopefully you have an approved site plan so that we can issue those land under development endorsements. In the standard transaction, the lender will usually ask for an Alta 9, which provides them with certain coverages as to restrictions, encroachments, and mineral rights, which you don't really see come up in Massachusetts, but it's still in the ALTA form. The owner will usually get an ALTA 9.2, which provides certain conditions, covenants, and restrictions coverage. Because of the encroachment coverage provided in the ALTA 9, we consider this a survey-related endorsement. And in order to provide that endorsement, obviously, we'll need an ALTA survey.
Most of the endorsements on this list you need a survey for, and that's come up a lot. I'm just going to pivot for 1 second.
Sure thing.
You know, we're getting a lot of questions about, well, not a lot, but there's sometimes people want us to use an existing survey. And we can in some situations. We have to, first of all, we have to review the survey. We need to take a look. How old is it? Is it an ALTA survey? So several factors go into whether or not we can accept the survey. And then also we need to have a survey affidavit of no change as well to accompany that. But a lot of these endorsements will not be available unless you have a survey, which comes as a shock to some people.
Right. So ask the question early on, I think, is the rule.
Yes.
Is the point. Yeah. Moving on, the ALTA 14 series, future advance, lender only. These are loan disbursements made post-closing that are not related to construction disbursements. The ALTA 17 series deals with access. If you have direct access to a public way, you're dealing with the ALTA 17. If you have indirect access to a public way, meaning you're using an access easement or some sort of private right-of-way to get to a public way, it's the 17.1. And then the ALTA 17.2 provides, you know, what utilities you have access to. And again, survey related items, we must have the survey in order to provide these endorsements. The ALTA 18 series is the tax parcel endorsement. There are different versions of the endorsement. If you have a single tax parcel, if you have multiple tax parcels, and if you have multiple tax parcels and are insuring an appurtenant easement. We have to make sure what we're dealing with as to whether or not we've got a single or multiple tax parcel situation. The ALTA 19 series contiguity, again, there are contiguity endorsements for multiple parcels. There's a contiguity endorsement for a single parcel. And you may say, Margaret, it's a single parcel. But what can I be contiguous to? Well, if, for example, we're insuring an appurtenant easement, you may very well ask that we recognize that the parcel of land is contiguous to that appurtenant easement, particularly if it's an access easement, you don't want a gap or gory in between. This is a survey-related endorsement, and to issue these endorsements, we will ask for a contiguity statement from the surveyor. ALTA 22 location, also a survey-related endorsement, because we're looking at what is at the site, and the surveyor will provide us with information as to the number of stories of building, what type of building, what the street address is, and the like, which we'll use to populate the ALTA 22 endorsement. ALTA 25 series is the survey endorsement. I call it the same as survey endorsement, and what the company will require is a statement from the surveyor on the survey saying that the land depicted on the survey is the same land that I've described in my commitment. And if I get that statement, then that enables me to issue the ALTA 25 series endorsement to the insured, which essentially says the same thing. ALTA 26 endorsement as to whether or not the parcel complies with subdivision law. ALTA 28 series are the encroachment endorsements. 28 is the building encroachment into an easement. 28.1 is building encroachment over a lot line, or the building on your neighbor may be encroaching over to you. It's forced removal coverage. And we're in order to provide those endorsements and to provide those coverages, I want to see the encroachment on the survey. I want to see what I'm dealing with. You know, I want to see who that neighbor is. Are we talking about, you know, a 4-inch encroachment, or are we talking about a 20-foot encroachment? Are we talking about an encroachment onto Mr. and Mrs. Smith's property? Or are we talking about an encroachment onto property owned by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? Are we talking about an encroachment onto registered land property? Because as you know, in those last two instances, you cannot adversely possess against registered land, and you cannot adversely possess against property owned by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So our arguments there as far as, well, look at how long the building has been there, and it's a de minimis encroachment, and nobody has complained. And the balance and the equities, as you're weighing the risks, the risks are obviously much higher if you're dealing with a more significant encroachment and you're dealing with entities against which you cannot adversely possess. So in making that determination and doing our due diligence, we want to see the encroachments that we're dealing with. The ALTA 32 and 33 are the construction loan endorsements. The ALTA 2 recognizing, or the mass version of it, recognizes that this is a construction loan, and it recognizes the amount of the loan that is being dispersed at closing. Post-closing, when those date-down disbursement endorsements for that construction loan are being requested by the lender, we will run title and update title, bring title forward to a particular date and time, and then recognize the current disbursement that's being made and recognize the aggregate sum or aggregate total of the disbursement that the lender has made of their loan. The ALTA 34, identified risk. For me, I most commonly use this in registered land, although, you know, that is not to say you only use it in registered land. Essentially, an encumbrance exists of record. And the underwriter, it's there. It isn't going away. It hasn't been terminated. It hasn't expired per its terms or by time. And the underwriter looks at it and says, well, you know, from a risk perspective, an insurance perspective, the chances of that being enforced, you know, are so small. I can't, but the encumbrance exists. So I can't omit, but what I can do is provide comfort. I can provide an endorsement that provides comfort as to enforcement of that encumbrance. And that's the ALTA 34 identified risk. ALTA 39 policy identification, that would be electronic signature. We used to issue those with the ALTA 2006 policies. Now the ALTA 2021 jackets right at the top have those coverages incorporated in the jacket, and therefore we don't include those anymore. And then finally, I know we're running out of time, waiver of arbitration. You know, the 2021 jackets, quite honestly, have provisions in them that say that any policy that's issued for a liability amount over $2 million, in order to go to arbitration, both parties must agree to the arbitration. However, notwithstanding that, it's been tradition and practice in Massachusetts, at least, for counsel to request those waiver of arbitration endorsements. And we still do issue them, notwithstanding the changes to the jacket.
Clayton, I'm just going to do a quick wrap up, I promise. I know we're pushed on time, but sure. You know, there are some other slides that you'll see. We've forwarded the slides to the team here, and they'll distribute them. But I guess, you know, just to summarize, remember, no one section of the title insurance policy should be read in the vacuum. Coverage is always subject to the exclusions, conditions, exceptions, and endorsements of the policy. So it's the whole policy in its entirety. So just think about that when you're asking for coverages or, you know, asking for an exception to be removed. It's, again, the whole title policy, not just one section of it. Mm-hmm. If you have any questions, we didn't have time to go into escrow and closing procedures, but if you have any questions about how that works, you can feel free to reach out to us. Is there anything else you want to add real quick?
Our contact information is on the last slide.
Never mind.
Believe me, it's there. I promise you it's there.
They'll be on the distributed slides.
So thank you, and we will cede the floor to Clayton.
Great. I thank you both, Jill and Margaret, for putting on a great presentation. I think on behalf of Spencer and myself and the Boston Bar Association, thank you for everyone in attendance for joining us today. For future programming with the real estate section at the BBA, keep an eye out for the Boston Bar Association website and their calendar there. And have a great rest of your afternoon to everyone.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more.
This special offer is only available through March 15, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.